You are listening to an edited version of Get Radio's Business Brunch, which airs every Sunday at 11 a.m. on DAB Digital Radio across Oxfordshire and online at getradio.co.uk. For copyright reasons, we cannot play the songs mentioned in the show. But for more info and Business Brunch related content, head over to getradio.co.uk.
Get Radio's Business Brunch with Ben Thompson, sponsored by the Oxford Business Community Network. The friendly, no-pressure networking group for Oxfordshire's business people. Discover our membership packages to help you grow your business at obcn.co.uk.
Good morning, this is Get Radio and welcome to the Business Brunch with me, Ben Thompson, owner of Thompson & Terry Recruitment. Every week during the show, we share the stories, the expertise and the knowledge of business leaders large and small with you, the listener. And this week is a brand new topic and a really interesting Oxfordshire-based business. So we're joined by Jonathan Stobert of Smart Garden Products here in Abingdon. And Jonathan's kindly going to share the story of Smart Garden Products and also talk about the gardens centre sector in general, which will be really fascinating. This is the Business Brunch with me, Ben Thompson. I look forward to welcoming Jonathan after this. Get Radio. Welcome back to the Business Brunch here on Get Radio. If you are just tuning in, you're in for a treat this morning. We're joined by Jonathan Stobert of Smart Garden Products in Abingdon. Welcome, Jonathan, and thank you for joining me.
Hi there. Nice to be with you.
So, Jonathan, for those who aren't familiar with you or indeed Smart Garden Products, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, sure. My name's Jonathan Stobart. I'm the founder and managing director of Smart Garden Products. We are a 23-year-old business specialising in the gardening sector. We have a very wide range of gardening products covering about 12 or 14 diverse product groups within the gardening area. Not plants, I have to say, not horticulture, so mainly what you might call hard goods or accessories. And we supply, I want to say, a large number of retailers in the UK who have a gardening space, particularly garden centres, but also some of the DIY superstores and the supermarkets who have a modest but nevertheless a gardening footprint within their stores.
Amazing, amazing. Lots to talk about over the show. As I think I pre-warned you, the hardest question that our guests get asked is to choose a song and be a radio DJ for a moment. You have kindly chosen a song this morning. What's your song choice and why have you picked it?
Well, I don't know if this is a very appropriate song or not, but I follow an amazing indie band that I came across a few years ago, and I'm going out on a weird, crazy gig to see in California next month for three consecutive nights. So my favourite song is by the very well-known Airborne Toxic Event, and the song is Welcome to Your Wedding Day.
Oxfordshire Station, Get Radio.
Welcome back to the Business Brunch here on Get Radio. Following that great song chosen by Jonathan, we've heard about Jonathan's background and indeed Smart Garden Products. So, Jonathan, I'm really keen to start with a big question, if that's OK. I want to go back 23 years. How did the business all come about? What was the, I guess, that pivotal point that led for you to launch the business?
Well, I was working for another company at the time that was a specialist in solar products, photovoltaic products. There was a combination of both industrial solar panels and a downstream consumer goods business selling a very small range of what at the time were very innovative solar lights. So literally, we had four or five items. And to cut a long story short, the business actually got into financial difficulty. So I started Smart Solar from the ashes of that company, focusing purely on consumer goods. And for the first 10 years of our life, we were an out-and-out specialist solar products company, solar lights and solar fountains, solar water features. And 11, 12 years ago, I got approached by a very successful entrepreneur in the gardening space who had built up and after 20 years sold his business and having had a few years out was keen to get back in the game. So we got together and we got on very well. And that resulted in I'd sold him a large stake of what was Smart Solar and became Smart Garden Products with a remit to extend our product group into loads of other different gardening categories and make garden centres not the only but the prime focus of our distribution channel.
Amazing. And if we stay with the Smart Solar stage of the business, What was the transition like? I always find it fascinating for business owners who have been in PAYE jobs previously. How did you find the transition? Was it what you expected going back to that time?
Um, it, I'll try not be revisionist because it's obviously when you start a business for anybody, whatever type of business it is or scale, I think it's very, very challenging. In a way, it wasn't a complete shock. I've been a sort of general manager in the previous company. So in terms of having the responsibility and experience on both the buy side and the sales side with customers and suppliers, that was unchanged. But obviously having the total responsibility and of course raising the money was a different level again. And I guess the biggest single thing is making sure that A, you plan and you have sufficient cash flow within your early years as a business. Those are absolutely paramount. There's no avoiding really, really hard work and having a sufficient cash to enable you to sustain and grow the business.
Really interesting. And I think that would be a really good time to talk about COVID, because COVID was a time that impacted garden centre certainly. How was that for you as an organisation, and what did you see during COVID for your sector?
We actually were incredibly lucky, I have to say, from when Boris came out and made his announcement, and we sort of thought we were going to fall off a cliff edge. I wasn't worried about the business's ongoing viability, but just certainly a long-term temporary closure. But actually, after 6 or 7 weeks, the announcement was made that garden centres could open. And that was an absolute lifeline because it meant that we were able to literally open for business, obviously on with all the caveats and securities in place, but we're able to supply products to our core customer base, which were garden centres. And guess what? In those early stages of COVID, when people were allowed out, there were very few places they could go. Garden centres was one of them. So in fact, many both retailers and suppliers had a incredibly good 2 years over that time because people re-engaged with their gardens. They were spending time at home. They were turning their gardens into extensions of their houses, if you like. So it really was a boom time. We were well aware, I must say, though, that it was an artificial a balloon, let's say, of sales. So our sales went up hugely. The costs went up a lot because also at the same time, cost of getting stock to customers went up by a factor of 10. So we didn't make all the extra profit you might make, but we took a view. We didn't put our prices up, unlike many of our competitors, to go for the long-term view. And while sales did dip down in the aftermath of COVID, they've gone back up again. And in fact, if you ignore the COVID years, as we call them, in our sales growth, it's still a very nice upward trajectory.
It's really interesting. We for regular listeners will know we've had 600 guests on this show, and you know what? I think that long-term view is often pays rewards so many times over, doesn't it? In terms of the garden centre sector now, how has that changed over a 23-year period? And how is that sector now as a whole here in the UK?
I mean, overall, the garden centre sector is pretty positive at the moment. There are, of course, caveats, things like the increase in national insurance, because garden centres employ, relatively speaking, quite a lot of lesser paid and part-time people. So they get hit disproportionately hard by some of the recent tax increases. So those are unfavourable. But the bigger positive is that garden centres have fantastic footprints. They are, by definition, usually in out-of-town, very nice locations with ample parking. A lot of them have fantastic cafes and restaurants, as well as, of course, amazing wide selection of products. The term garden centre is almost a misnomer with some that are home and garden centres rather than just garden centres. And actually, as the high street has demised somewhat over the last few years, garden centres are in pole position to really capitalise on making it easy and comfortable and less stressful going out shopping, because you can park, you can go and have something to eat or drink, you can go to the loo, you can do shopping, and you've got kids, a lot of them, they have attractions bolted onto to them as well. I mean, weekends, if you go to virtually any garden centre in the country, you'll find that the car parks are absolutely heaving. And I'd also say that as a sector, the garden centre industry is very heavily populated by a lot of multi-generational families. So there's a lot of businesses that have been owned by parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and have cascaded down the generations. And pleasingly, many of the each successive generation takes over the business as well, not in all instances. But it means that there's a huge amount of passion and commitment that I've not seen in any other industry. because it's very, very personal. Because you obviously you're working at weekends, you have to have a very, very strong work ethic. But as a result, as I say, the high street has become less popular. The good retailers are doing very, very well. They have to keep reinventing themselves. I think that's so there's a sense of theatre and drama and interest because you get a lot of repeat customers who come in, and so you have to have a different, slightly different experience each time, as well as knowing where to go and buy your staples, for example. So I think they are very well placed, and overall, many have done very well over the last few years. But you know, it's difficult to make necessarily a huge amount of money, but you have a very good sustainable business, and it's a very enjoyable business.
Absolutely. And I think that final word that you've put there in terms of enjoy is so important, isn't it, in our working career. I find it really fascinating where you're talking about all the different facets of a good garden centre. I live in Abingdon, and went to Millet's Farm when I was well, from being a baby, and just seeing how that's become a whole gone from a small garden centre and a farm shop, well, originally just a farm shop, to a whole day out. Do you see that garden centres are gonna continue growing in a way like maybe Millets have, albeit they are sort of a farm, aren't they? But do you see that being the future, that some of the smaller operators at the moment will continue to grow and add things like soft play or Santa at Christmas or more house products?
Yeah, I think subject to space and obviously cash, all those things are viable. And again, you can recreate your space because of, by definition, we're in a seasonal industry where what you're selling varies during the year, whether you're selling plants or bulbs, for example, in the pure horticulture sector, or the types of accessories, or as you touched on, Christmas. Christmas has become a hugely important part of business for many garden centres. And it makes a lot of sense because traditionally in the autumn, garden centres are relatively fallow. The tills are not bringing quite so much. Whereas actually, if you encourage customers to come in for a Christmas shopping and Christmas experience, then you transform your cash flow and of your engagement with your staff, because you can re retain and recruit people all year round rather than having to have cycles of flow and ebb on your employment levels. And garden centres are really good at creating fantastic experiences in store. I mean, some of them go to incredible lengths, creating tremendous Christmas displays and grottos, many of which are booked up and sold out weeks or months in advance. And of course, they've got the space again to do it. They've got good car parking. You've got things like electric vehicle chargers coming into more and more. So it's also convenient whilst you're shopping, you can charge your car. You mentioned play areas. Some many many garden centres have those. Some have amazing additional facilities like, you know, ice rinks or putting greens, those types of things. So you know, you can go on and on with what you as much as your imagination, because of what you bolt onto it that sustains good, positive customer experience all year round.
No, amazing. Really, really fascinating. Thank you, Jonathan, for your thoughts so far. Let's have a song and we'll continue the conversation after this.
Introducing you to local trusted experts. This is the Business Brunch, sponsored by the Oxford Business Community Network, the friendly, no-pressure networking group for Oxfordshire's business people. Sign up to our mailing list at obcn.co.uk.
Welcome back to the Business Brunch here on Get Radio. If you are just tuning in, we're joined by Jonathan of Smart Garden Products, who are based in Abingdon, a wonderful Oxfordshire-based business, making a really, really big impact across the UK. Jonathan, I'm really keen to talk about product selection, if that's okay. And before we talk about a garden centre, I'm really keen to talk about your business. For anyone who looks at your website and talks to you, will see that you have such a wide range of products. What is the process of selecting products, and how has that developed over the years? I'm just really fascinated to understand.
Well, it's top secret, Ben. I'll share a few little bon mots with you. So we do have a very rigorous and surprisingly emotional product selection process that we go through. So we have a range of category managers who champion each of the product group. One of their roles each year is to is to select, design, introduce prospective new products within their particular product group. And then we go through a process of, you know, designing the products, getting samples in. Then we have a big meeting with a selection of both the product team, some of the sales team, and a couple of people such as myself and the marketing team, and my partner, who is very vocal about product selection. And we are incredibly detailed in discussing and selecting which products, not just that what we like, but we think have got genuine sales potential. And by that, I mean reasonably high volume sales potential. We're operating in, I'd say, the quite wide middle market. We're not very top end. We're not bottom fishing. We're in the very center of the market. But at the same time, we're mindful that the majority of the products that we supply are probably retailing between $9.99 and $29.99. And we're very focused on the retail price. Even though we're a supplier, not a retailer, we're very in tune to what we think is the optimum retail price for a product. You can have the best product in the world, but if it's crazily expensive, no one's going to sell any, so there's no point. So we're trying to make sure we introduce products that are appealing, but also they're priced correctly for consumers to be able to buy them. So we probably end up with let's say there's a product group, and we think we want to maybe end up with 30 new products in that product group for the following season. We'll first of all cull the ones that aren't performing very well. We have some minimum thresholds they need to generate. And then if we want to generate 30 new products, we probably have about 100 on the table. And we get all that 100 to sift down before we get to 30. And then they have to be photographed, they have to be catalogued, they have to be coded, they have to be sampled, that we have to set up in our showrooms and exhibitions. So there's a huge process that happens. And you multiply that by 12 for the different product groups, it's a hell of a process. And we get very emotional, very heated sometimes about championing specific products that we think will sell in the market. Ultimately, the acid test is the following year when we introduce them, whether people buy them or not. Fortunately, we mainly get it right. We don't always, but we have a good track record of not only introducing products that sell well, but quite a lot that sell incredibly well. I mean, really, really big numbers. And you get a bit of a feel. Ultimately, experience comes into play to a degree of which types of products, what look might be of interest. And you're absorbing all possible feedback to help fine-tune your selections. What other products are selling at the moment? They're not necessarily in the same product area, but they're influencing what colours and styles are popular at the moment, what figurines seem to be popular in other types of industry. And you try and bring that in and see if you can capitalise on that as well. So it's a bit of a smorgasbord of ideas and process.
No, absolutely. And in terms of what makes a really good product, you spoke about price in terms of that right price point. And I imagine across your categories is going to really vary. But is there a particular trait of a product that you think, do you know what, this is really successful because it appeals to X or because it's got Y? Or is there a trait that you see?
Well, I think, I mean, there are certain product groups, for example, plant support, where it's quite difficult to create a new bamboo cane or a hanging basket. Yes, you can, for the hanging basket, you can create a different design, but the bamboo cane is a bamboo cane, so there's not much scope for bringing in new design or ingenuity. However, in some of our categories, there absolutely is, and probably what we're best known for, where my heritage in particular is solar lighting. And solar lighting is an amazing category for us. It's our king category. And it really, you could sort of break it down into two parts, one of which is what I would call functional lighting, where you're buying the light whose prime purpose is to generate light, and it's more a functional light. You'll generally find them more on the back wall in retailers, what we call on the slat wall. So, whereas a bigger volume for us are what we call decorative solar lights, where they are lights, and some of the lights are very, very powerful. But as important is the decor aspect. It might be a figurine whose eyes light up, or internal body lights up. So why are you buying it? You're buying it because you like the figurine or the aesthetics of the product as much as it's because it's a light. It's a bit of fun. It makes you smile. And a lot of our products have humor. A lot of them have personality. We give names to all of our products. Every product has a name. It's not just got a number and it's got a generic name. And that brings a personality to every product. It might sound like a small thing. Maybe many people miss it or don't care, but surprisingly, quite a few really do. And then they start turning into collectibles. So you can extend the opportunity for having kicked off with one particular product or product name. So yeah, we think we're pretty good at delivering products that work well, bring a smile to your face, and are readily affordable.
Yeah, no, amazing, amazing. And in terms of your products, I imagine that there's very few, if any, of your clients that would have every single one of your products. How does a garden centre go about putting together a product range to fit within their space and within their clients? What's that process?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because whilst we supply a lot of garden centres, because our range is so big, I'd like to think that the selection that any one garden centre has is unique, because there's no way they can stock all of our range, even all of one of our product groups. Take solar, for example. When we've got something like 500, 600 SKU items in the range, they will only be maybe stocking 200 at best. Could be 50. So the selection that they choose is partly on what they like. A key part of both helping our customers and a selling tool for us are our showrooms. So both here in Abingdon and at our logistics hub in Peterborough, we have big showrooms where we showcase all of our product groups. All merchandise. It's not just products. We recreate sort of a garden centre feel, and the optimum, therefore, as a garden centre customer who comes to see us, and we have a lot of customers who come and see us, is to look round and say, "I want this," or "I'd like that 2 meters," and we'll supply the display, and they'll populate it with a selection from our range that they really like. And importantly, we are a pure B2B business. We don't sell direct to the consumer at all. And we do that for a very important reason, is that we can look all of our customers straight in the eye and say, "We do not compete with you. We will only supply you. We will not go around up behind your back or discreetly selling online or trying to do something. We only supply to the trade." And that's relatively unusual in our industry. It's just a personal standard we have, but it gives a lot of comfort to our customers that they know we're not going to be trying to compete with them at the same time. We're purely there to help and supply them.
Really, really interesting you say that. Very off topic within my own business. I run a recruitment business, and one of the things that I really feel is the future of our sector is it makes no sense for an employer to be recruiting against an agency, because the second you're competing, who somebody wins and somebody loses, or there's not the perfect experience. And I think the same can be said for so many sectors, and it's certainly been really successful for our business. So no, really, really fascinating that it's worked for you. I'm fascinated to build on the family piece, if that's okay. So earlier in the show, you mentioned about garden centres being great for families. You in terms of kind of that ownership piece, but also I'm now keen to move on to the customer piece. I think a garden centre is the one place, certainly from the uneducated mind, where you often see the grandparents, the parents, the children, the cousins. How do you build a garden centre to be? Or a garden centre product range, I think I'd like to focus on, to be really exciting for the whole family. What's that process?
Well, I think it's difficult to give you an absolute answer that addresses all that, but I guess in trying to make sure that you have a wide range of products that cater for designs, pricing, and appeal to multi-generations is the key. We all know that the cliche of your garden centre demographic customer is a slightly older shopper, the proverbial grey pound or almost grey pound. I'm not sure that's quite true. I think what is probably is true, that traditional gardening is more a hobby of older people, and I use that word deliberately because older could mean older than 30 or 40 rather than say old people. But COVID was also very helpful in igniting interest and enthusiasm for a lot of younger generation to take up gardening. And a lot of newer houses have actually smaller gardens, which is what a lot of people prefer, and relatively low maintenance, which is also what is more and more popular. But that also opens the opportunity for selling different types of products that would appeal to the younger house owner or the new homeowner who wants to maybe decorate their patio or a small garden area. And they have to be very choosy about what they're buying because of space. And also they want to do things that give instant appeal in many instances, where they don't want to spend a lot of time on their knees planting and weeding and looking after plants. So you're trying to, on the one hand, cater for traditional products and traditional items that will appeal to, let's say, what we call core gardeners, which is not necessarily age-specific, but probably the older half of the population, whereas a lot of the more decorative types of products, some of those or many of those will probably appeal more to the younger generation. I think you mentioned yourself about Millet's Farm, for example. Families going, you can go and have a nice play and look at the animals, go and look in the garden centre, and they can have a look at all the sheds and the playhouses in there as well. So it can be a really good cohesive family experience. So you want to make sure that you've got items that potentially everybody in the family would be interested in buying.
Absolutely. No, really, really fascinating. Really, really fascinating. Let's have another song and we'll continue the conversation after this.
The Business Brunch Podcast with Ben Thompson. Sponsored by the Oxford Business Community Network. Discover our membership packages to help you grow your business at obcn.co.uk.
Welcome back to the Business Brunch here on Get Radio. And if you are just tuning in, please, please, please do head over to the Get Radio website or indeed any major podcast provider and do listen back. As today we're joined by Jonathan of Smart Garden Products here in Oxfordshire, based in Abingdon, who has really given such an insight into their business over the last 23 years, selection of products, and then also the garden centre sector as a whole. Jonathan, looking from an outside, one of the things that you as a business are really good at is marketing. Talk to me about how to market a product. And I appreciate that's a very big question, and probably how long is a piece of string and so many variables. But marketing is a big part of the product piece, isn't it? Talk to me about how that process. I'm really, really fascinated.
Yes, it is. And if I'm being brutally honest with ourselves, I think it's an area that we actually can improve. And of course, the world is ever changing with increasing use of social media, that you have to try and tap into all relevant channels. Whilst at the same time, as I said earlier, we're a pure B2B business, so we're not really actively involved nor spending money on the consumer end of it. But I'm also aware that by generating interest at the consumer level, you can obviously drive traffic to your retail customers in particular. So for us, the prime marketing strength, if you like, first of all, sounds very basic, very banal perhaps, is packaging. So the packaging has to work, has to get across the messaging very quickly, very succinctly. Sometimes the packaging is very minimal. There are legislative requirements, so you have to try and cater for those as well for some products. So trying to make the packaging look appealing so people want to pick it off the shelf and open it up or take it to the till is obviously important. We do a lot of product in displays, either freestanding displays, or we provide graphics and materials for internal displays for merchandising units. We supply a lot of custom merchandising units for our retailers as well, not just on the shelf, but freestanding so they can move them around during the course of the year. So all of that is important. Sometimes we have products that are actually working. So we have, for example, water features that are can be plugged in, so they're operating, so you're getting a feel of what it's going to look like when you get home. We increasingly use QR codes on packaging or on point of sale. So if it's particularly a product that lights up at night or it's moving, you can, with your phone, and use the QR code to get a link to see what the product looks like in situ, if you like, rather than just on the shelf. And actually, that's become very, very helpful. And I'm also going to say across all generations, that using QR codes is not the preserve of only the young. Again, during COVID, a lot of people got very used to using QR codes, maybe for other reasons, but actually what that done is it's made it not seem so alien. It's much more commonplace. So using QR codes is also helpful. We have our website, but our website is mainly predicated to trade buyers rather than consumer buyers, but it provides information. And we give, I don't know if you would say it's marketing, but our customer service to me is an extension of marketing. We have a fantastic team. If customers buy a product and they have a problem for whatever reason, we'll really try and help them and sort it out at the consumer level, not just at the trade level. So it's a whole suite of things that we try and do to optimize the flow. The last thing I'd say is social media. Our presence is pretty thin, and we're learning as we go. And obviously AI has come in now, which has kicked it up to another level. But we will, over time, do more. We liaise and tie in with a lot of our customers with their own online social media presence. So I think that's an area we probably can develop more, And it's great to hear stories actually for even some of our customers who've run fantastic campaigns and they've received a very dynamic increase in sales of specific products. So I think so far so good, but still more to do.
No, really interesting. And I think this is very much a trade secret. But I think after hosting this show for so long, I think a lot of businesses we speak to are aspirational. So they're a business that similar to yours would sell to retailers or to garden centres or whatever. Probably not as much as garden centres. And I think everybody wants to be in the big brands, don't they? They want their products in the middle aisle in Aldi or whatever. How have you gone about over such that period of time getting into so many big brands and really growing the business in that way? What would be some of the things you would put it down to, and what's been that approach?
Perseverance. It's a number of things. I mean, ultimately, I'm going to say that of course, you've got to have an attractive product proposition first up, and that doesn't just mean that the product aesthetic looks good and is good quality, but of course, it's priced correctly as well. And differing retailers have different positions in the market and different type of price points that they keen to promote. You might have some retailers who are, let's say, retailers at slightly lower price points, and mainstream supermarkets are probably sort of the middle ground, if you like. So you might be adjusting what types of products you offer to them to hit their sweet spots. But then, end of the day, a lot of it is down to good customer interface, giving the customers what they want. So we have a very wide range of products. We're very innovative. We have a bank of intellectual property. We're not just going and putting something off the shelf and turning it around to someone. Sometimes we do find products that we just resell as we found them in our buying manufacturing partners in Asia, for example. But a lot of the time we're creating and developing products for customers. And we might develop a different type or style according to either what they want or what their customer demographic would like to buy. So we're really trying to sell categories rather than products. So if we're talking to a major retailer, we don't really want to sell them, nor do they want to buy just one or two products. They want to buy a proposition, which might mean 1 or 2 meters of shelving in their store, which is populated by 20, 30 different products covering different price points, different levels of appeal. And we want to own that space for them, if you like, by giving a selection of products that will really sell by making sure we're hitting different price points, hitting different types of application. And I think we do that bit very well. And we might try and make it very easy to deal with us. We don't put barriers to entry. If you're supplying a lot of the bigger retailers, it's also important that you know how to navigate quite a lot of red tape and certification and requirements and legislative requirements that you have, which are, guess what, getting more and more onerous year on year, not getting easier. We've had challenges, obviously, post-Brexit with changes in legislation on that time. But we have a team that we employ outright in China. We have a team of 32 amazing people who are employed by us. They're not agents, who help manage our logistics and supply chain team. A lot of our big customers buy from us through China directly, so we can handle that with our own team in China as well as here in the UK. So we're trying to make it easier. It's my common thread. We try and make it easy for customers, whether you're a small independent garden centre or whether you're a mass market supermarket. We try and apply the same philosophy: give them good products, well priced, and give them most of all fantastic service.
Absolutely. You mentioned the Brexit word, and I think it's a word that I think a lot of our listeners would be really fascinated to hear. What did Brexit mean for you as an organization, and how did you navigate that and thrive since?
You're at risk of getting on very dodgy territory there, because I am an unashamed Ramona. I am still pretty angry about Brexit. To me, it was very clear that it was going to be a very poor result for the country. And I'm sure, like many people, have also very good friends who think differently, and that's fine. But I think what's been misunderstood is that, A, I don't think Brexit certainly has delivered any of the projected benefits that people thought. And I think it was slightly optimistic, let me say, to think that it ever would. And dialing into what the hard reality is for us, and I feel it very well because I have a thriving European business, and I'm a European. We have fantastic relationships with French, German, Italian, Spanish customers, particularly in France. I employ six people outright in France. The impact for us has been very significant. First of all, it's cost us a lot of money because now the cost of both shipping and the legislative requirements and customs going into Europe is net positive compared to what it was. So that's hit our profit margins, and that we have to raise our prices, which we prefer not to, to absorb all of that. And it's also time, the amount of paperwork you have to do now. It's unbelievable how much more bureaucracy there is to do per trade or product compared to when we were part of the EU. The biggest thing, I think, beyond that, to be fair, it is now diluting down because we are 7 or 8 years on, but it was the impact of how Britain was viewed by a lot of our European partners. A lot of our Europeans were surprisingly sort of hurt that, you know, what have they done that, you know, Britain was taking this strangely quasi-suicidal route and turning its back on our nearest trading partners and long-standing friends. And it was very difficult to open new business in Europe for many, many years. If you had existing customers, hopefully you could graft and hang on to them. But trying to get new customers in Europe has been very, very difficult the last few years because they understandably turn towards European, continental European suppliers where possible. That is beginning to change, but some of the aforementioned issues still persist. And it's a cause of irritation to me because it's created barriers and cost issues. And I also see at large, I'm very involved in export in our industry, that fewer and fewer businesses are exporting because they just find it too difficult, too expensive to do. And that's not good for the British economy at large. So you'll see from my reply that I'm not happy about it, very frustrated about it. And I would really love any colour of government, I don't care what colour the government is, but to revisit at least something like a customs union or some way of removing this unnecessary friction that we have in trade between the UK and Europe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, thank you. It's really fascinating to hear your views by a business that is so involved and clearly has so much knowledge. You know, we've heard from other guests, as I'm sure you can imagine. But yeah, no, it's really interesting to hear your insight there. We are coming towards the final stint of the show, and I feel like a bit of a fraud asking you this, Jonathan, because you've been given tips and insight throughout the whole show. But one of the things we do really love to leave our listeners with is a broad business top tip. So for the Oxfordshire business owner listening to this show right now, if you were to suggest that they highlight something in the notepad that we've discussed already, or if you would like to mention something new, what would be your business tip that you would leave with them after 23 years of running such a well-regarded brand here in Oxfordshire?
It's always very difficult when one's asked this I always try and avoid coming up with something it's difficult to avoid something that doesn't seem quite obvious or quite glib. But there's a small number of things that I think are absolutely prime ingredients if you're setting out trying to start or grow a business. And they are fairly obvious, but I think they're worth repeating. The first is you have to have a passion for what you're doing. I don't think you can be successful if you don't really believe, and not just believe, but really passionately want to drive the business forward. You can't create that artificially. You either have it or you haven't. So, you know, if you're starting out, I hope that one does have it, or else you're probably not going to do very well. You need to have a plan. It's surprising how few businesses don't properly plan. That's in terms of how you're going to try and get your product or service to market, and what your ambitions and goals are, and obviously need the cash to do it, and you need to continue, you know, reevaluating that, what progress you're making. But the other thing I would say is that I think that this might sound a bit of a weird thing, that I think that we are, say, good at is something that we do, which might sound harsh, is that we are endlessly self-critical. We are always trying to improve. Never sit back on your laurels. And our business is doing, frankly, very well. We're in a good place, but I'm not saying we're not never happy, but we're always trying to do better. Never get complacent. And in fact, often when things are going well, those are the times not to sit back, but to see how can we make it even better. And I think that having that attitude towards your business is probably the best driver of success, all underpinned by bloody hard work.
Absolutely. Great advice, great advice. And what a way to end the show. Thank you, Jonathan, for sharing such honest overview of your business, your views, your experience throughout. I think it's been absolutely fascinating and really, really enjoyed the conversation. So thank you. If you are just tuning in, by all means, do listen back. But also do head over to the Smart Garden Products website. I appreciate Jonathan's rightly said, they're a B2B business, but some really good insight there, which I very much enjoyed reading. Finally, just a reminder, you can listen to this show on the radio every Sunday at 11 a.m. On radios in your car and at home and at work all across Oxfordshire, or online anywhere in the world. Do look out for the podcast version, which is released on every major podcast platform and is released on the Monday morning. And if you would like to see our lovely guests, do look out for the video version, which goes out on the Get Radio Facebook page and their website every Tuesday. But for now, whatever you're doing here in Oxfordshire, enjoy, and we'll see you next week.